Okay. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this lecture on green bonds. My name is Sam Fankhauser. I'm co-director of the Grantham Research Institute here at the school. And Grantham, many of you, I hope, will know the institute. Grantham is the location where a lot of the climate change and environmental research happens at LSE. There are, you know, lots of researchers across the school, but most of them, I hope all of them, are affiliated with us. And climate finance, environmental finance, green bonds is one of the things we are doing at Grantham. So it's a great pleasure to chair this event tonight, which is not a Grantham event. It's actually organized by the LSE Sustainability and the Student Union for Business and Finance Society. I hope I got the order of all those words right. It's my pleasure to introduce two speakers who are both analytical in the sort of the great tradition of LSE as a center of thinking, but also are doing something much more complicated, which is putting these things into practice. I'm sort of looking at Sean Kidney at this point, who is going to open our discussion. And the reason why I'm doing that is he's still preparing his lecture notes over there.
And that's normal, right?
I shouldn't say that in public, but I used to have a lecturer when I was studying. It wasn't at LSE, it was at some other university that I shall name. And his lecture notes were on a BA napkin, so we knew exactly where he had prepared his notes. Two speakers, which I introduce very slowly until Sean is ready with his notes. Sean Kidney will start off the discussion. He is the co-founder of the Climate Bonds Initiative and a very sort of enthusiastic and energetic cheerleader of climate bonds and green finance. He will start our lectures. We then have Suzanne Bukta. I hope I got the pronunciation right. I did check beforehand. Suzanne is Managing Director in Debt Capital Markets at Bank of America Merrill Lynch. And so one of her jobs, not her full-time job, is to structure and sell and make green bonds happen, and she will talk to us about the practical challenges of a great concept and how it sort of works in practice. So that's the plan. Each of our speakers get about half an hour, 25 minutes to half an hour, which will leave plenty of time, hopefully afterwards, for your questions and for a lively discussion. The only final housekeeping rule used to be please switch off your mobiles. That's no longer the housekeeping rule. The housekeeping rule now is please put them on silent and please tweet about this event. You see the hashtag behind us, LSC Green Bonds. Use that hashtag and tell the world what they're missing by not being here. Again, the mobile on silent stone. Okay, Sean, I hope I've talked long enough
that
for you to be ready.
Very good filling in, Sam. Thank you.
It's sort of my attempt to a filibuster, but it's time really to start our talks, and we start with Sean Kidney. Sean, please.
It worked. Brilliant. So you know my name. I run a little NGO called the Climate Bonds Initiative, with rather an absurd and crazy objective, which is to mobilise trillions of dollars of capital for climate solutions. We focus in particular on the bond market, which, as you probably know, is about $100 trillion outstanding, versus the equity market that bobs up and down between 60 and 70 trillion at any one time outstanding, if you like, depending on what's happening in the Chinese stock market. So it's the larger, quiet, usually unsung brother in the capital markets. It's an area that has largely been ignored when it comes to climate solutions. I have a particular interest in focusing on the bond market, which is not to do with them being bonds or not. It's to do with how you construct investment propositions in the bond market. We have somehow spent 20 years thinking about how investors should take on risks associated with fixing our planet. Investors are often told they should take a bigger bet on solar or take a bigger bet on new energy storage technologies, solutions because it'll save us all. But the truth is that these are risky investments and it's hard to make a straightforward financial argument. And you've seen this in solar stocks in the last few years. If you're a pension fund or if you're an insurance fund with certain fiduciary duty obligations, there are some arguments. It's risky, but it's going to be big reward. That's great, but that's a small slice of the investment pie. In fact, what we've been doing is asking investors to take on societal risk, which is quite hard to do unless they all take it on in a uniform fashion. In the bond market, you can't have this argument. There is a ratings requirement, often driven by legislation that we as a community impose upon our savings institutions, insurance funds and pension funds, for reasons of financial stability, for reasons of being sure that your pensions, God forgive an astounding thought at your age, but that your pensions will be able to be paid back in 40 years. So as a result, you have typically insurers that might have between 70 and 90% of all their assets in bonds, and they're lumped in sort of tiers. I don't know what the tier looks like. Suzanne may be able to run it through us, but it's sort of like a big lump of AAA. That is, they're forced to buy AAA. They've got no choice but to buy gilts, despite them not being a very good investment now, because of their legal requirements. Then a big lump of AA, then a bit of yield at A. And then down here, you've got a bit of BBB, and God knows if they're lucky, they can put a little bit of pot in BB and get some kind of return in these days of extraordinarily low interest rates in Europe. So if you want people to invest, you have to design products that fit into the yield and risk requirements of investors, rather than saying, arguing, no, you need to get more BBB or BB down here, forget about the AAA, it just doesn't work, because they're governed by different laws. Now that's, for me, a really useful discipline, because the truth is, we are not going to achieve the extraordinary transition that we need to achieve globally if we try and argue investor by investor. We are going to achieve it if we can make it easy for the people who have the capital in the world, our pension funds and our insurance funds, to invest. That's the basic proposition. I'm here today because one particular market, the green bond market, still relatively small, has grown from a small base very, very quickly, tripled in the last few years. It's a market made up of institutional investors, largely, and fund managers on one side, and blue chip issuers, banks, large corporates, development banks on the other side, and municipalities. It looks a bit like this, the chart. That's what's grown in the last few years. You can see there's a bit of variety in issuance. It was originally largely a development bank market, European Investment Bank, World Bank, and then suddenly in 2013, a little bank in Washington, D.C. called the IFC, International Finance Corp, issued $1 billion of a green bond, flat priced, if you know what that term means, to their other bonds, and sold out in 1.5 hours. And it was like 3 or 4 times oversubscribed. And everyone thought, whoa, what's this? A few months later, a second one. Out of nowhere appeared this market, the corporate green bond market, on the back of this crazy idea that you could have a blue chip institution that would segregate some of its funds, fully backed by the IFC corporate treasury, and the funds would only go to climate change solutions. Interesting. Hypothecation. Treasuries usually hate this stuff, but it worked. And on the back of it, look what we've got. Quite a nice $42 billion market on the way to a much bigger market this year, I believe. So that's the story. That's why we're here today. why I'm here today. What's going on behind this? Well, clearly it's about investor demand. We've had a lot of people come out and say they'd like green bonds. In Paris, we released a statement with investors representing 11.2 trillion who said they really want green bonds, they were going to work to grow the market, and they're going to work with us and other bodies, like the green bond principles, and we'll come to that a little later. The US economy, by the way, is about 17 trillion GDP per annum, so it gives you a sense of scale. At the UN Climate Summit in September of 2014, we had investors representing $43 trillion sign statements that they wanted to see climate change addressed. They saw it as a major risk to their portfolios in the long term. And they stood ready to invest. And then the insurance industry topped them, representing $20 trillion, came out and said, well, that's all very well, but we're going to make a tougher promise. We're going to promise to multiply by 10 our climate-related investments by 2020. It's pretty cool. Problem is they haven't got enough product. They can't find the bonds. Green bonds that are starting to appear are an example of what they want. And since then, there's mandates. Why are they worrying about this? Well, the truth is that over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of education of investors by actuaries. The Institute of Actuaries put out a great report in January of last year, basically saying that their portfolios, pension fund portfolios, were likely to be totally decimated by 2050 on current trajectories around climate change. Arguing in numbers. We have a number of international investor associations that have been working assiduously to educate about long-term risk. So we now have a large pool of investors who manage your money and Sam's money and my money and Suzanne's money because they're insurance funds and pension funds who understand the long-term macro risks, are fully aware of it, and regularly sign these statements. There's a problem. Most of their portfolio management is in a 3 to 5 year horizon, and they're having a real difficulty figuring out how to bridge this. Now, some are doing it anyway, within the confines of what of risk management in the current day. So we have a whole movement to recalibrate the understanding of risk around fossil fuel investments, led by Carbon Tracker Initiative, which has been a great development in the last year, which is basically saying, look, you've got to take a chance that at least some of this stuff, oil reserves and coal reserves, is going to have to stay in the ground if Sam Funkhouse is right, surely. And sure enough, people are now beginning to put a risk premium on these assets. That's great. The second thing is we've developed this idea, thanks to the IFC and others, that there's one way you can bridge in the short term until you have a better understanding of where to invest your money for this future we need to build in green bonds. This is a bond which has the same yield and risk characteristics. Remember what I said earlier about manufacturing it to suit the risk requirements of pension funds? It has a bonus feature. That is, the proceeds go to fixing up the planet and saving the world. Nice little bonus feature. A bit like a set of steak knives. When you're faced with that choice and you're an investor who is concerned about the long-term risk, it's quite hard to say no. Because you've suddenly got a means of reporting back to your stakeholders that you are doing something on climate change without sacrificing risk or yield in your portfolio. And that's the basic premise that's driving the growth of this market. You know, the risks involved aren't exactly minor here. If you start reading the science reports, if you read the IPCC science reports as distinct from the filtered by Saudi Arabia final report, it's chilling reading. The International Energy Agency, when it puts out its World Energy Outlook, has a scenario, a current business as usual scenario, that is frankly terrifying. Fatih Birol, the chair of the International Energy Agency, not a particularly wild and radical body. They could, for example, coordinate the world's petroleum reserves. He's on record as saying we are barreling towards catastrophe. He believes on current trajectory we'll see a world of 6 to 7 degrees warming. Sam can tell you what that means. Johann Schellenhuber, I'm not asking you just now, but you can come back a bit later. That's okay, Sam.
A shell shock, so keep going.
Mr. Schellenhuber, the chair of the German government's Climate Science Committee, WGBU, and the CEO of the Potsdam Institute, argues that the difference between 2 degrees and 4 degrees warming is, quote-unquote, civilization. If you want to read a really scary piece just to get your blood going, delve into James Lovelock's latest gloomy tomes, where he talks about losing 2 to 3 billion of the world population by the end of the century, and frankly, it's too late anyway, we've lost it. James Lovelock, the author of the Gaia Theory. When you start examining the risks involved, and this is all risk, right? We could be hit by a meteorite tomorrow, hey. But if you look at the level of risk of this kind of outcome, it's the sort of level of risk that would make an airline pilot have a nervous breakdown on the spot. This is risk levels of 50% or more. These are not good prognostications for the future. These are prognostications that will see massive desertification. That will see weather volatility like we haven't seen. Failure of the monsoon potentially every 5 years with extraordinary impacts on the subcontinent. We've already got our first climate change war, which is Syria. In 2007, 2008, we had 1.6 million people move off the land in Syria because of failure of crops because of heat incidents. Where did they go into the cities? They were managed very, very badly by a repressive regime. And guess what? We have a war. Hey, there's no surprise about this sort of thing. And we're going to see a lot of them. Europe ain't seen nothing if it thinks the million of people coming across the Mediterranean is where it's going to stop. We will see dominoes of this under current business-as-usual projections. Now, it's important to understand just how severe this risk is, what kind of legacy my generation is leaving your generation. It's a pretty miserable legacy when it comes to the state of the world's climate. Now, I'm hoping that before I fall over, we can fix it, because we only have about 5 years. There isn't the time for you to solve it in your adult working life. In fact, Christiana Figueres says, the head of the UNFCCC, if we haven't fixed this in 5 years, we're in an extremely serious state in terms of our ability to head off catastrophic climate change. I'm not a climate scientist. A climate scientist will be much more cautious, as they always are. I'm someone who reads the odds and thinks, if I was an investor, I would take this as a dead cert, this future, if I was an investor. So investors do see this and understand that there is a risk. And as I said, there is a problem, because most of their management of funds is relatively short term. Not as short term as a corporate in the US. A survey of CFOs in the US 2 years ago said that CFOs would nearly always sacrifice 3-year returns for a 6-month return because of the nature of incentive structures and pressures they're under. This is a problem for dealing with a long-term issue like climate change. At least the investors we speak with are thinking in a 3 to 5 year horizon. We, of course, need to be able to shift to a 20 to 30 year horizon. Okay, my last bit of bad news, just to drive it home, have a look at the Lancet article, as I think about depression amongst climate scientists. You'll realise that actually 20 years of banging on the wall trying to get something to do is taking a toll on our climate scientists. There is a minor epidemic of depression, it would seem. That's an example of the extent to which we have not listened to the messengers. And I'm going to say, actually, we have pursued a strategy over the last 20 years of focusing all our energy in carbon pricing, which has proved to be a drastic distraction from what we need to do. Despite it being a great theory, frankly, in search of a practical application that works, what it's done is avoided us looking at another area of solution, which is now time for us to look at. And now I'm going to shift to opportunity. I see two opportunities to address this rather terrifying spectre. I'm going to call it a horror of a future that we have painted and created for us. One horror, one opportunity, I should say, is what the International Energy Agency, for example, tells us, or the new Climate Economy Report tells us about how this change can be addressed. The bulk of things that we have to do, the larger proportion outside of stopping deforestation, can be characterised as green infrastructure style investments. It's energy. It's mobility, low carbon transport, 23 to 27% of emissions. It's water, huge consumer of electricity. In California, 17% of all electricity goes to pumping water around. You can make that more efficient, you're making a big difference. And, of course, adaptation in water. And various other things. It's buildings, energy efficiency, and so on. So the urban infrastructure. So I'm going to allow myself here to call buildings part of infrastructure. Allow me that just a little bit. Most of these things have a great, really exciting aspect to them when it comes to the challenge we have ahead of us. They can be created, they can be made investable. In fact, when you think about it, infrastructure has never been something really which is created by free market fiat. It is engineered investability. So when you build a freeway outside of Chicago, you decide to get private capital in for 75 years, as Chicago did at Macquarie. You give them a floor price to make it palatable for the investor. You effectively do what the US did for energy investments in the 1950s and have capacity remuneration underpinning your whole energy system. That is, you say to someone, build me a plant, I'm going to give you a 6% return, no more, no less, but whatever it costs, I'm going to give you that return, and that's how I ensure input of energy into my system. We do this in many ways. In fact, if you think about it, we've got 150, 200 years of building infrastructure. London, all around you, from the sewers. Infrastructure mediated by the state, built by the state. When you start thinking about this as a big green infrastructure challenge, a whole wealth of opportunities to act open up to us because we use them every day. Let me give you an example of a couple of years ago when we pulled teeth out of Treasury in the UK to get £3 billion for a green investment bank. 2 years later, there was a housing crisis. Treasury found pretty well overnight a £50 billion guarantee pool for social housing. Overnight. Like, I would have used that in the Green Investment Bank, guys. And why? Because they generally see that housing is a fundamental economic multiplier in the economy. They don't see green that way. And so they wanted to boost the housing sector. That's how treasuries think. That was a classic tool that treasuries have and use day in and day out to make sure that the right kinds of things are built for whatever framework they're looking at. If only we could merge, if only we could merge that idea of green and economic multiplier for housing, wouldn't that be cool? Or if we're going to merge green with infrastructure, wouldn't that be cool? And guess what? Actually, we have. Treasury missed a trick because social housing is largely green. They could have actually set precedents for the rest of the country and said, we will only guarantee green housing. They wouldn't have even had to do it. But everyone would have thought, my God, what is going on? Treasury's guaranteeing green housing. The building industry would have taken notice. And what's more, they could have been fiscally efficient. They gave 100% guarantees. AAA bonds were issued as a result. What a waste of a credit rating. I can't find an insurance company in the UK that's very keen on AAA. They buy them because they have to. No yield. They prefer an A-rated bond. So Treasury could have done a partial guarantee bond, partial guarantee pool, and allowed five times or four times as many bonds to be issued. Green housing bonds, right? Could have been a market for Suzanne out of this. But instead, they wasted because they were not thinking fiscally efficiently. So this is what we confront. Treasuries around the world are using these tools, are just not thinking about the greatest challenge facing the millennia. Repairing the disaster we have created in our own nests. But that's opportunity, right? That's opportunity. The second opportunity is that we have a world awash in capital. I mean, when you think about it, we are paying the German government to take our money. We are paying the Swiss, the Swedes, the European Investment Bank to take our money. Siemens has 16 billion euros on deposit with the European Central Bank because it can't figure out what to do with the damn thing. I mean, really? Has anyone looked at the clean energy investments required around here? Or the mobility investments? What kind of extraordinary disjuncture do we have in this world today between over here, where our climate scientists are telling us, and the IEA tells us, there's $53 to $90 trillion of investment that we must make to avert catastrophe so your kids have half a chance of a reasonable life, and over here we have money that says it doesn't know where to go. Now, there's got to be some way to match those two puddles, eh? It's got to be some way. Well, luckily, we've at least convinced these investors that there could be something in it. Doesn't mean money's flowing at the scale. But that's the starting point. This particular graph that I showed you is evidence. All it is really is evidence of investor demand around this. Evidence that is bait for governments. So through this, we suddenly open up, we are opening up conversations of governments around the world to say, oh, investors do want this green. What have we got to do again? That applies to the UK Treasury, by the way. Is there anyone from the UK Treasury here? We'll talk about that later. So we now are beginning to get engagement on the back of this particular market, which is essentially discovery. When we talk about what's got to happen in this market, we talk about three things. We need to rebias our economies. We know that. The OECD tells us day in, day out, we've got a 10-to-1 ratio of fossil fuel subsidies to clean energy subsidies. Yes. We also need to rebias our planning systems. No more tollways and freeways, please. Only urban transit, let alone buildings, let alone all the infrastructure that we build. Water infrastructure should never again be built without a proper climate adaptation plan and a mitigation plan, reduced energy usage, rather than these massive energy consumption systems we continue to build. They're simple, right? A bunch of engineers in LSE and other places know the answers to this. So that's the first part, rebiasing our economy. The second part is we need to lift up the green investments because there is no history. That is, S&P can't give them a reasonable rating, if you like. So therefore, we can't slot them in to the right ratings levels of all the pension funds and insurance funds. They come in at BBB or BB sometimes, and we've got to get them in about A because that's what people need. We're having trouble. This is a classic market transition, so that's okay. We need a few years of risk enhancement. Luckily, we have a world full of pools of capital that could be used to do this. They're called development banks. We have hundreds of billions allocated to development banks around the world, which are being misused, in my view. They need to be used to leverage private sector capital. There's a particular reason why I'm acutely aware of the need to use private capital. And that's because one of the things we know about the 2 degrees, 2 metres sea level rise adaptation that we are stuck with now, that we are not going to be able to avoid, one of the things we know is the poor are going to suffer. You can be sure, 100% sure. There will be suffering in the poor. There will be suffering in Bangladesh. There is going to be some pretty ghastly news coverage out of it. Any public sector dollar you have is going to have to be allocated towards the alleviation of the problems of the poor who are experiencing the impacts of climate change firsthand. Syria, guys. So everything else needs to be made investable so we don't use up those little paltry amounts of public sector spending we have that we can allocate to the poor. That's why this is so important to go forward. Rebias, lift up, credit enhancements, tax guarantees. There's a whole smorgasbord of kits, some of which are banned by orthodox economists, but it works. It works. I've had an argument with the World Bank for the last 3 months about promoting the use of tax credits for green bonds. They will not do it because of the orthodox, I'm going to call it, orthodox economic situation in place. Sam doesn't really agree with me, I think. But I'm saying, I don't care if it's messy, as long as it works. It's a 5 to 10 year period, we can tidy up afterwards. So the Chinese are bringing in tax credits for green bonds. Of course, the US, the home of tax credit. I mean, the place that still has 100-year-old tax credits for oil and gas industry, go figure, does have tax credits for various kinds of interest. It has muni tax credits, which is building infrastructure for munis, and it has some dedicated tax credits for green bonds, QEBs and CREBs and things like that from the Obama administration's first term. And then the third thing, just to get this going, is what we call a discovery. Let's make it easier to figure out. How do you know what kind of transport is relevant to the transition to a low-carbon and climate-resilient economy? Is it easy? Do you know? Well, when I first started talking to investors in London about this a couple of years ago, they said, no, electric vehicles probably, not many of those, won't worry about that. When they come along, we'll invest in them, right? And I said, well, you know, rail bonds. Rail bonds are more important than electric vehicles. Significant modal shift. Incredibly efficient, especially if it's off electric grid powered by renewables, which, of course, all our grids will be by 2040, right? So rail investments are high-priority, low-carbon infrastructure. Oh, they said, really? I've got some rail bonds. Does that mean I can report to my stakeholders that I've got green bonds? Yes, you can. That's called discovery. So we're working on the discovery aspect. This is what the green bond market has been so far. Renewable energy largely. Energy efficiency, nice. Small, but nice. That's got to be 40% by the time we're finished. Low carbon transport, a bit of water, and now we're beginning to see a bit of agriculture, forestry, and so on. It's all around the world. It's not just in Europe. Whoa. Last week, $5 billion were issued in China. In fact, China, we believe, by the end of this year, will be the largest single country issuer of green bonds in the world. India's even done 1.1. Even Japan's done $500 million, and they're very cautious there. Mexico, Brazil. The United States was about $10 billion of the $42 billion issued last year. So you get a sense that this isn't just the UK. In fact, the UK is pretty small, 0.7 billion. Come on, guys, phone up your pension funds. Tell them it's time to buy something. Probably the only time you'll ever have an excuse to phone your pension fund. This could be it. Of course, the labelled green bond market, the stuff that we talk about as green, is only labelling, right? It's stuff that has, let's call it, been discovered prior to issuance. We talk about a $600 billion outstanding market of bonds that should be labelled green if you bring in all those rail bonds that no one's thought of as green. And of course, what counts is money flowing to the right asset. But this is really useful because it reduces friction, a classic economics term, and as a result, money flows faster. That's why the labelling is so important. We, of course, want to make that full universe of $600 billion outstanding, about $100 billion a year issuance, green, pretty quick. And that's going to be good because it's going to give us scale and liquidity. Whoop. I think we can get rid of a liquidity premium at that point, Suzanne. I suspect. But, of course, our ambition is $1 trillion a year. Why? Because if you're looking at $5 to $7 trillion a year that's got to be invested in climate solutions, if the bond market portion is less than $1 trillion, we ain't getting nowhere. That's a minimum target that we need to achieve. By 2020, if we double each year, we are going to get there. If we don't double each year, think about investing in land in northern Siberia and getting a few guns and burying them in the ground, is my hunch. There's a report you can get on our website all about this. Bunch of things on our website. Just to keep clear about the kinds of things. And what we're talking about now is the shape of the transition to a low-carbon and climate-resilient economy. It is not about clean energy just. That will probably be 10 to 15% of investments. It is transport, not just electric vehicles. Rail of all sorts, particularly electrification, bus rapid transit systems, all sorts of vehicles, infrastructure. It is water investment, sustainable water, water infrastructure. And remember, adaptation is necessary because we have left it so late, we've messed things up too much already. So we better start investing. Waste and pollution management, methane control, recycling, various kind of agricultural investments, even ICT and broadband. Why? Because it is an enabler of smart cities. It is an enabler of logistics improvements. It is an enabler of so many things. It needs to be caught. Now, that requires a bit of a picture of what the transition is going to look like. And that's what we're missing too often. We don't have a clear enough idea of what are the kinds of investments we're going to make between now and 2050. We've kind of got energy. You know, there's arguments about energy storage, about nuclear. Sort of doesn't matter. There's a robust argument. We've got a good filter. We could all argue the IEA is too cautious in its prognostications, but that's an argument. What we're not clear about, there's only been one interesting global study around the mobility solutions. A pretty aggressive study, I have to say, by the Institute of Transport Policy Studies in Japan in 2009. The IEA is working slowly on something. We don't really have a transition plan around water. We don't have a sense of the scale of investments, of what we've got to do, of how steep those emission cuts out of the Californian water system that uses up so much electricity needs to be, and so on. This is one of the challenges. The new climate economy dabbled in this area and started doing it. But over the next few years, we've got to see a lot more work about this. Now, a bit of a silver lining out of COP, or rather, ray of sunshine, I should say, we think the INDCs, these country climate change plans, are the beginnings of that revolution. Very weak, not enough, but hey, people are now submitting climate change transition plans. Okay, put together by ministries of environment, largely in those countries that no one listens to, but there is at least a plan. If we can make those investable, if we can make those a trigger for capital flowing, could we actually embolden the countries to do more about their transition planning? Yes, we can. And that's something we're working on, as a number of other organisations are working on this year. We'll see, perhaps by Morocco, two or three countries assertively link investment plans to INDCs. It's an opportunity for us going forward. There's a bit of information on our website that you can read. I just want to finish up, because I know I'm over time, with next. The understanding of what 2050 must look like in a 2 and preferably 1.5 degree world is pivotal to making decisions now. It must be a science-informed framework. It is not up to amateurs to make this call. And by amateurs, I'm talking about governments. I'm talking about investors. I'm talking about people like me. It must be science-derived. Too many arguments are happening now about coal retrofits versus non-coal retrofits. We need that informed by proper emissions reductions curves. That's my first point. My second point, there is a huge opportunity to conflate, to bring together, to merge the green and infrastructure agendas. The G20 has two different working groups, one on infrastructure, about where that man in the bright coloured shirt is over there, and one on green finance, where Sam is. This is not good. In fact, this is stupid. There should be no infrastructure in the world that is planned from now on that does not have a climate change adaptation filter on it, and preferably a mitigation filter where possible. It just shouldn't happen. I mean, it's about investment, right? Infrastructure's got 100-year life. We know the world's going to be different in 100 years. What are we thinking, building something without taking... And haven't we seen the impacts in the UK in the last few years with floods? Infrastructure built badly. We do have an opportunity with the COP to convert those things from meetings of ministries of environment to meetings of ministries of finance. When we know, the way we will know we're successful is that that's exactly what happens. I suspect it's going to take a few years. What's going on behind all of this? You know, there is a tussle of ideas going on here. There is a fundamental intellectual battle going on. The simplest and first is this battle about our consciousness of being stewards of the planet, about accepting, despite our resistance, that it is the Anthropocene, that we have created the world we are now having to deal with, and therefore we have a responsibility to create a world going forward. To be conscious instead of to be juveniles, bumbling around the forest, kicking down trees, not thinking of what we're doing. We have acted as a juvenile species far beyond the time when we should have given up that role. We no longer have the luxury of acting as juveniles. We must, to have a chance for our children to have their own juvenile life, shift to being adults really fast. It's like you're 19 and something bad happens and you have to grow up overnight. Well, that's what we're in now. So that's the first contest that is not an accepted idea around the world. That is an idea that is absolutely contested. The second idea is that we must think long-term, not short-term, because of that first idea that is necessary for us now. It is no longer, again, a luxury, a juvenile luxury, to allow ourselves to think. We think in 6 months or 3 year times and everything will sort itself out in the long run. That is no longer an option for us, because that has got us to where we are today. We must, it is imperative that we start thinking, well, 40-year time frames. The first one is 2050. Our world, we are making choices right now that will shape the planet in 2050. And as Christiana Fugere says, if we don't make enough right choices by 2050, the choice is taken out of our hands. It's taken out of our hands by feedback loops, by tipping points, by a variety of escalating climate change scenarios. So 5 years to grow up, guys, and 5 years to show evidence of growing up. You'll be just in the beginning part of your work. I hope you will choose work, whatever you do, that will give you an income and make a difference to the planet. Because in times of crisis, in times of danger, we all have a responsibility to act, whether you're 19 or 69. And that's what we have in front of us. We have an opportunity to act. Remember, I said two bits of hope. One is, this is eminently doable. Green infrastructure, for example. we have this incredible moment in history, more capital awash than we have ever seen before. The lowest interest rates in modern history in Europe and even in the US. Surely, with the brains of our financial system, with what you've learned here, we can find a way to bridge these two buckets. The bucket over here of capital that we're swimming in, and the bucket over here of all those $53 trillion to $90 trillion of things that we have to do to create a future, to invent a future as adult stewards of the planet that we can live in. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sean. I told you that he would be an enthusiastic champion of green investment. Hope he has lived up to that moniker. Let's now turn over to Suzanne, whose job it is to actually do all those green bonds and green investments. And in due course, you're going to do $1 trillion a year, Suzanne.
That's right.
I'm working on it.
Over to you.
Thank you. So we'll see if I get through this without coughing and hacking and making it absolutely miserable for you guys. I've got my cough drops, I've got my water, so we should be set. When I first got interested in green bonds, it was 2010. I came across the product and thought, oh, I can actually finally find a way to incorporate alternative energy into my day job at the bank. So we put a pitch together for our boss, the head of capital markets, and said, look, these things have been getting done, but in really small size, predominantly with AAA issuers who pay really low yield, and it's very much a niche market. But we think we could expand this to many, many of our capital markets clients who are doing things like building railroads, retrofitting their stores to be more energy efficient, building green buildings, putting solar panels on their roofs, etc. And he was a good boss. He said, it's interesting. Go talk to the head of syndicate. So we went and talked to the head of syndicate. He said, you're crazy. Investors don't care about this stuff. Nobody's going to buy a bond because it's green. Finally, in 2013, we led the Korea Export-Import Bank transaction. It was about 2 days after the transaction Sean mentioned, where International Finance Corp did the first $1 billion green bond. This was from Korea's agency of the government that worked on improving exports for Korea, and they used some of the proceeds for green projects that Korea was working on in various jurisdictions. It was a $500 million green bond. It finally paid a little more coupon because Korea is still considered an emerging market, and so it pays more yield. The next day, the syndicate in Asia sent a message out to everybody in all of capital markets that said, green is the new black. So I smiled. ESG investing, raise your hand if you know what ESG investing is, or at least have some idea, heard the term. Okay, so many of you in the room. Essentially, instead of only looking at your quarter over quarter financial returns, as an investor, you're going to look at some other factors. How is this company doing in regards to the environment? How are they doing socially? How do they work in the communities where they live? And how is their governance? Do they have good risk controls, etc.? With the thought being that if you also measure a company on these three factors and take the intersection of good financial performers with good ESG performers, you can get better long-term financial performance. And this has been underway in the equity space for 15, 20 years now. And it's really just within the last 3 to 5 years that it's been making its way over to bonds. And it's ESG investors that are particularly interested in green bonds. You already saw this same graph up here on the left-hand side that Sean showed you, which is that the green bond market has really taken off, which is why we're here talking about it today. Now, granted, in a given year, the investment-grade bond market will do something like $2 trillion of investments per year, and we're only at a total outstanding notional of... cough number one, $90 billion. But we've seen significant upward growth, and we've seen corporates, municipalities, AAA supranationals, and financial institutions all come into the mix. We've also seen various regions, including Asia, now come into the mix. Asia really kind of blossomed last year, and as Sean said, we think that's going to be one of the bigger growth areas of this year. On the right-hand side, we used to only be able to list a few bonds over here. Now we can't even fit the last 6 months' worth of bonds. And we particularly highlight them green if Bank of America Merrill Lynch underwrote them. But you can see that they're coming from all different sectors of the economy, from utilities, from companies that do buildings, from government entities, from municipals, et cetera. I gave a talk a couple of years ago where I tried to break down what I thought of personally as the different types of green bonds. And now a lot of us discuss the various types of green bonds in the marketplace. There's probably a fifth category that we should add on here that I'll talk about, but we haven't really seen examples of it yet. So the first is what we call the use of proceeds green bond, and I'm going to come back to this in a minute, but it's a very simple concept because you essentially buy a bond with the exact same credit that you always know and understand and the exact same yield that you know and always understand, but they just promise to use the proceeds for green projects, which makes it very easily accessible. You can do a similar type of bond, but having municipality issue it. And I put the municipality in a separate bucket because it really operates, at least in the US, under its own tax scheme, its own legal scheme, its own documentation scheme, et cetera. So it's tracked in a completely different way. So we separated out that bucket. What starts to get more interesting is bonds where you actually take direct exposure to a renewable project. This is a lot of what Sean was talking about, investing in renewable infrastructure. But to get there, you need to actually understand what is solar, what's a solar farm, what's my risk to a solar farm, et cetera. Whereas in the first and second bucket, you don't really need to understand that. You just understand the same credit as always. But because it's more risky, harder to understand, et cetera, you also can get paid a higher return in the project risk bucket. And then finally, and this was a little bit of a bad word for a while, but asset-backed securities are another possible form of green bonds. If you take a bunch of green assets and pool them into a bucket and have that bucket issue cash flows that are coming in from the assets out to the bondholder, that could be a green asset-backed security. So I'm either going to bore you to death or I'm going to actually interest you in a bunch of real-life transactions that have happened in these different categories. So again, just to run through the simple first category, the use of proceeds green bond, the beauty of it is that it is simple. It's a bond, senior debt, issued by either a corporation like Bank of America Corporation or a supranational like the World Bank or let's come up with another corporation. Toyota issued one of these. So it's very simple credit that as an investor you've probably already done the credit work on and you already understand. The yield is the same. You're not giving up yield to be green, which was one of the big battles that we were facing initially, as there was a perception that if you do green things, you're going to lose money. So you get the same yield, credit you already understand. The only difference is the issuer promises to use the proceeds for green projects. And it will spell out in the bond documentation what kinds of categories it intends to use them on. Green buildings, or solar and wind farm loans, or mass transportation projects, etc. And then the investors require the issuers to follow up and report on an annual basis on their website where they've spent the money and what impact those projects have had on the environment. Why would an issuer bother to do this? The issuer doesn't save money, right? The green investor doesn't want to get less yield, so the issuer doesn't get any real benefit for doing this. They could borrow the same exact money and not have to report anything on a website and not have to promise to use the proceeds only for green projects. But it's got some pretty good public relations. They get to relate to the investors that care about this, and there's a growing number of those. And there happen to be a lot of news stories written about them, and you can be sure that Sean will blog about it. So, for example, we have a Climate Bonds Initiative quote up there. But one story that came to me is Regency, which is a company in the U.S. that builds green buildings. They do Whole Foods, the shopping centers for Whole Foods, and they did a lot of collaboration with them about how can we make rainwater capture on the roof to water the plants in the store? How can we do cisterns under the ground to capture water before it has huge stormwater runoff? How can we flush the toilets with this water? All kinds of fun stuff. They do a bond once every 4 years. You never can find any news story on their bond. But if you Google Regency Green Bond, you get about 20 news articles. So they were pretty happy with the publicity on that. And as I mentioned, these ESG investors are growing in number. And it feels like every week or every other week in the past couple of months, we hear of a new investor saying, I'm either going to commit $1 billion to buying green bonds, or I'm creating my own green bond fund, et cetera. So the investor diversification matters to issuers. In addition, now there's starting to be indices that track green bonds. Merrill Lynch has an index which basically takes everything in the Bloomberg Green Bond database and intersects it with its usual indices of liquid bonds. And if you're in both of those places, you're in our green bond index. MSCI also has a green bond index. Theirs is slightly more restrictive, so they don't allow certain types of green projects. If you're building a new factory, they don't care how energy efficient it is. They would prefer to retrofit existing factories. If you're doing really large-scale hydro projects, they'll often block that out as well and cap the hydro projects at 25 megawatts. So going back to these types, we've really covered off quite well on the use of proceeds green bonds. What I'd like to do now is run through some different examples of all these types to give you a flavor of what's actually happening in the marketplace. So in that same year, 2013, which we've shown was kind of a marquee year because 2014 really took off based on the precedents set in 2013, those precedents were, in my mind, the $1 billion transaction, which was the largest one ever done. 2 days later, the transaction from Korea, which actually paid more yield than ever before. And then about 6 months went by, where we were busy writing the green bond principles. And then in November of that year, in the same week, Bank of America Corporation issued a green bond, and then Electricité de France, I don't know, do you guys have that for your utility here in the UK? Because I do. They issued a green bond. So in the same week, we really finally broke into the corporate space. Bank of America used its $500 million worth of proceeds, it's already been all spent, on various solar farms and wind farms that it lends to in the United States, as well as some retrofit projects for things like social housing in New York City and projects in Oakland and San Francisco in terms of street lighting, et cetera. Last year, it felt like there was a marquee transaction every week. We had repeat issuers, so we had the World Bank, European Investment Bank, KfW, EDC. Those are supranationals that all did repeat green bonds. You actually, by this time, 2015, 2 years later, even had repeat corporate issuers. So Bank of America did a second one. Unibail Rodamco, which is a real estate company here in Europe that builds green buildings, they did their second green bond. And we had a repeat from EDF. They actually brought a green bond into the US. And then you had new corporate issuers. So Transport for London did a green bond, very exciting. We had Sumitomo Mitsui Bank from Japan do their first green bond. And we had Agricultural Bank of China. So you start to see Asia come into the mix. In fact, Exim Bank of India, I was just in Mumbai on Friday, noticing how heavy the pollution is, which I was unaware of, and thinking that at this pace, we cannot keep growing and emitting this much without having Beijing-type pollution throughout the entire globe. And I thought, okay, I hope India does more green bonds, and I hope I make a big donation again to Nature Conservancy to offset coming here. Some other key points from this year are repeat green bonds, new green bond issuers from corporates, and the emergence from Asia. So those are the real highlights that I would like to point out. When we started doing this slide at the beginning of 2015, we were trying to say, hey, look, green bonds are starting to come from all over the globe. And my favorite thing about this is now you can't even see the globe. So we've now had green bonds from Peru, from Mexico, from Brazil. I already mentioned all the various places in Asia, including Philippines, et cetera. All over the US, Canada has issued a couple, all over Europe, and the UK has issued a couple, Unilever and Transport for London. I mentioned that municipals trade in a different way in the United States. In fact, they're tax exempt. And one of the discussions, and Sean brought it up, is what about tax exemption for green bonds? We've seen that being taken up in China, but so far nobody else has followed suit. We're waiting. But we've also seen green bonds from other regions, including Île-de-France, which was an area of France, but that actually saw investors come in from outside of France to buy their bond because it was green. City of Johannesburg, et cetera. Makes you wonder. City of London, green bond, could be interesting. What I think is more exciting is the conversation that all of this use of proceeds in municipal green bonds has started in terms of mobilizing the capital that needs to go directly to projects. So usually large infrastructure projects get financed on bank balance sheets. But we all know that bank balance sheets are getting constrained, that capital requirements are getting more intensified for banks. So will we be able to get the investors from Sean bucket over here of a lot of cash over to there where the infrastructure investments are? And what are the barriers to them moving over to those places? Well, one barrier is the ratings requirement. Pension funds need to invest in investment grade, which means triple B minus or better. So in November 2013, the European Investment Bank actually ponied up some cash, 15% of the total notional of this bond, which was £305 million, to be able to create transmission lines to this 100-odd wind farms off the eastern coast of the UK and connect them to the UK grid. But it takes money to build those transmission lines. The EIB ponied up some cash in order to create a credit enhancement for this bond. That credit enhancement enabled the bond to go to Moody's and S&P and get a rating of A3. So pretty good, well above triple B minus. And that then brought in an oversubscription of investors into this transaction. Now, we haven't seen that many other project bonds that actually have had a credit enhancement since then. But the good news is that these transactions are starting to get rated investment grade, bottom of investment grade, triple B minus, but investment grade on their own. So last December, about a year after the Greater Gabbard transaction, we did, not last December, the year before, 2014, we did $204 million of a bond that financed wind farms off the shore of Peru. So you actually had investors willing to take risk to Peru as well as risk to offshore wind, which just goes to show when you can't find much yield anywhere else, you're willing to do the work to start to understand things like resource analysis. How hard does the wind blow in that area? Is it actually going to generate energy? Vestas wind turbines, are they worth what they're made out of? What is the EPC and the operations and maintenance contracts look like for this wind farm, et cetera? And then I'm very happy to announce that just before we closed for the holidays this December, we did a almost $1 billion euro-denominated transaction for German offshore wind. This was actually already financed through construction on bank balance sheets, and they were looking to refinance the transaction at better rates, and they achieved better rates with the institutional investors than they could have on bank balance sheets. We wound up doing 45 different investors between the U.S. and Europe combined. And so in order to satisfy every regional investor's needs in terms of legal jurisdiction, denomination of the currency, et cetera, we broke this up into 9 different tranches. It was a little bit of a nightmare. But the whole thing closed, and it was a pretty marquee transaction, rated triple B minus by all 3 rating agencies. So I think this really shows development in the project bond aspect of the green space, and I find it quite exciting. Toyota, I mentioned, did a green bond, and I fibbed a little bit. They did an asset-backed bond, but the assets in the pool were all the regular and green car loans. So the gas guzzlers and the hybrids all together in a pool, regular asset-backed transaction like they would normally issue. I like to call it the hybrid green bond because it was a hybrid between a green asset-backed transaction where you would only have green car loans in the pool and a use of proceeds transaction where it would be senior debt and the proceeds would be promised. So what they did is regular car loans in the pool, not really green, but promised to use the money, $1.75 billion, only for new green car loans. And they were impressed that they were able to achieve an even higher miles per gallon target with the new loans than they expected, and that they spent all the money within 6 months. They've actually done two of these transactions at this point, because both of them were quite successful. Late last year, we led a transaction for Solar City. This, to me, is a true green asset-backed security. Solar City will put a we have similar types of things here in the UK, but the contracts work a little differently because you pay it through your utility. In the US, Solar City will put solar panels on your home and sign a 15-year lease with you. And then instead of paying $100 to your utility, you now only have to pay them $50 a month, but you have to pay $25 a month to Solar City, but that's fine because you're still only paying $75 a month instead of $100. And that $25 every month lease contract is something that Solar City can put into a solar asset-backed transaction. They had to take 10,000 of them, so 10,000 different homes, in order to have a $125 million bond, which is where investors start to care. But this is one of the first true green asset-backed securities in my mind. We can imagine similar things with mortgage-backed securities or covered bonds, as we call them here in Europe. Where you have green homes that have been retrofitted to pull very little energy off the grid, securitized, once we get enough product. So just some barriers to what's keeping these markets from growing faster. As I mentioned, with the use of proceeds, green bond, if you're not, as a company, saving money on the coupon, but you have to do additional reporting and you're restricted in your use of proceeds, why are you going to bother? You have to really care about proving to the public that you're doing green things. And we're seeing more companies start to care, but it's a little bit slow going. In terms of the projects, there's a lot of technology to understand. There's a lot of legal risk to understand. In some cases, there's construction risk to understand. And finally, with the asset backs, there needs to be a lot of collateral. 10,000 contracts just to do a $125 million transaction. And then you have to have those contracts standardized. And with different companies innovating at different points in time, it's a little hard to get that standardization. I think we will continue to see these markets grow, but we're still early days. Where do I see us going this year? Sean said he thinks the market will grow. Our researchers agree with him. They think we'll hit $60 billion this year. Not quite $100 billion yet.
We'll see.
We believe that will come from China and India, so to a large degree, to what Sean was saying, we will see growth out of those areas. We also think that we'll see new corporate issuers and repeat issuers. As I mentioned, it feels like every other week we're getting another investor commenting on, I'm going to commit $1 billion to green bonds, or I'm going to build my own green bond fund. We're hearing of investors that used to not really want to take our call when we would say, hey, green bonds, you should listen to this. Back in 2010, those same investors now call us up and say, hey, we've got some university endowment money that we're managing, and they want to understand what this green bond stuff is because their students are protesting on their campuses about divesting from coal. So can you come into our offices and give us a teach-in? So I think that's pretty cool grassroots, bottoms-up growth of the marketplace. The Green Bond Principles now has over 100 signatories, and Moody's has just announced that they're going to be doing a green bond rating scheme. So you can see that the market is growing in a lot of different areas, and there's a lot more people talking about it than there was 5 years ago. These are some stats on Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I won't highlight on that. And then this is just some of the ways in which we've been trying to provide thought leadership in this space. Speaking at conferences, working on how should the standards for these bonds grow, writing articles, et cetera. So I think all of those of us who are working in the space, from Sean to myself to my colleagues at other banks to the investors that care, I think I see Manuel in the audience, to the issuers that have done green bonds before, they have been participating in
ways in which they can get the word out. I asked somebody at work who was actually really pitching this a lot with her clients why she liked the idea. I mean, I love it, but I want to understand why others like it. And she said, oh, well, it's a lot like the ice bucket challenge, you know? It's just a really good way to get the word out.
Many thanks, Suzanne. That was a really fascinating tour through the Greenbond kitchen, as it were. And one of the things I liked, apart from the fact that students have influence over investment decisions, was the move from the use of proceeds to the, you know, to the project and ABS bonds, because that means investors start taking and understanding green risk, which I think is a good development. But let's open it for questions. We have about 20 minutes or so. My suggestion is that we collect a handful of questions and then go back to our speakers. You know the rules on questions at LSE. Wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and keep your questions short. Okay, who's got a question? There's a lady in the grey jumper right in the middle.
Hi, my name's Susan Casey, interested member of the public. Thanks for your talks. I realise you're dealing with really, really big numbers, but as you know, there's a lot of us out here who are desperate for yield from our banks, and I've asked one of my banks, you know, where's the green bond, where's the green ISA? Is this coming to the high street any time soon?
Okay, a question about retail products. Other questions? There's a lady in the middle with the glasses, and then I go back to you, sir.
Hi, I'm Annika, and I'm interested in socially responsible investment in general. And I'm wondering, what do you think is the role of asset managers? Are there actually a barrier, or could they be a chance of entrance for people in demand for investment?
The role of asset managers. So, gentlemen, just three rows back on the right.
Hi, thank you. You mentioned rating agencies just at the start. What happens when capital markets let rip? Derivatives are created, there's huge leverage, and then the Enrons appear.
The end results, the Enrons.
Okay, question about the Enrons. Shall we have a fourth question, bottom left there, sir? Don't go. What happened to my microphone? Go to there, right in the front. Thought you were walking out.
Ronan Tynan, I make films and that kind of thing, but I'm very interested in the environment. And well, I just have to ask this question because I think you made a very interesting point about that. Was it engineered investability and the importance of the state mediating these kind of structures? The question that I'm provoked to ask is that the tiny percentage that green bonds represent in the $100 billion global bond market is an indication of us not taking the climate crisis seriously almost. I put it to you really that it does seem kind of obvious, because I think after the Paris Agreement, I'm forced to ask the question again. And you made the point, Joe Kidney made the point at the beginning that it was very much, you know, the scale of the crisis. And I get the impression constantly, I put it to the panel as well, that people have almost become complacent. The idea that we can kind of legislate this away if governments, in inverted commas, really get behind it, when in reality, of course, it requires a fundamental change in our lifestyles, you know, moving away from meat and dairy because it produces more emissions than, shall we say, the transport sector. And obviously, we have to leave it in the ground. So this is really, of course, a revolution. So I don't want to drift on a bit, but I'm just concerned about the fact that really, unless governments get directly involved in the same way that they promoted war bonds, that's the kind of world we need to be in now if we're going to do it in the next 5 years. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you. Role of the state. I see a lot more hands. I suggest we go a little bit over there. I think I can take two more, then we have to go back to our speakers while they remember the question. You it's first and then the row. Just before. Please go ahead.
My name is Francesca from UNICEF. So I was wondering whether you see a role For the NGOs, actually, they are focused on renewable energy to play in this market, and what do you think that role is, especially thinking of those NGOs that actually focus on program implementation and development in this field?
Okay, and final question just before here.
Hi there, my name's Carl Asmussen. I'm from Natural Capital Partners. So I think it's great to see green bonds coming onto the market, but what's work's being done to avoid greenwashing, and how important do you see sort of the green rating? I know no one's asked that yet, so thanks.
Okay, it's time to go back to our two panelists. We have accumulated quite a few questions. Question about retail products, the role of asset managers, risks of sort of Enron-style hypes, the role of NGOs, the role of the state, and the risk of greenwash. Suzanne, do you want to...
I think I'm mic'd. Can you hear me? In terms of the retail question now, I'm more of an expert on the U.S. I've only been here for 7 months. And in the U.S., you can, as an individual investor, buy the green municipal bonds. I know I've bought some. I know my parents have bought some. They don't necessarily pay you any more yield because they're, as we said, these use of proceeds bonds. But I don't know that there's that available here yet, really, in the U.K., What I would recommend is speak to your pension advisor, because we've spoken quite a bit to UK pensions about the product, but we don't find quite as much fascination and uptake here as we do in, say, the Dutch pensions or the Swedish pensions, et cetera. So if they're hearing more and more from their individual constituents, I think that could be helpful. Can you remind me of the other?
Role of asset managers.
Oh, in terms of the role of asset managers, and I kind of alluded to this a little bit earlier, but we're seeing certain asset managers create green bond funds, which really drives the need for more issuance. So we can go to issuers and say, look, there's an actual green bond fund that will buy this bond that wouldn't buy your regular bond. So the more of the pure green bond funds we see, the better. Other asset managers haven't been able to create a pure fund, but they have made it clear that they are more interested in green bonds when they come out than regular bonds from the same issuer, and that they will kind of earmark it internally for monies that they're managing that are interested in green.
Do you want to have a go at greenwash?
Oh, it's my favorite topic.
I thought so.
So we actually require a lot of the issuers that do the use of proceeds green bonds. We require them to be very explicit in their bond documentation as to the categories they're going to choose so that the investor can determine whether or not they like those categories. And then the issuer needs to track the monies and figure out where they spent it on, and then they need to report publicly as to where they spent those monies, and if possible, to calculate a climate impact from that. All of that additional work for the same coupon that they would get on a regular bond. There's some debate as to what categories are actually eligible. For example, desalination. One green bond actually used desalination as a category. Some would say certain types of desal are green. Some would say it's not. Some investors will tell you we'd rather make up our mind on that for them ourselves. But for those that don't want to, I'm going to turn that question to Sean.
Okay, Sean, you want to have a go at this? And then we have Enron-style risks.
Ah, that's a good question, that one.
NGOs and the role of the state, where I know you're going to give the wrong answer, but go for it.
I don't think I'm going to give the wrong answer. I think we're one with that, Sam, aren't we?
Just try,
look,
try me and see where we end up.
You know, I mentioned earlier that one of the things we do need to do is to have a much more science base to our decisions about what are the right kind of investments to make. Ideally, I would like purpose, that is social purpose, to be fundamental to decisions about infrastructure, for example. And by social purpose, I mean making sure it's the infrastructure that's getting best for society. You know, that's not a hard ask, is it? And that's an argument about, you know, freeways versus railways and so on. I think we have a fundamental challenge ahead of us now, which an incredible degree of urgency, which is around climate change. And as a result, we need, at least for the short term, till we're clear of that, 2030, put a lot of emphasis on that as a primary filter for decisions we make in society. And we looked at the desal bond. We actually contacted them because we review every single green bond on the market. As Suzanne knows, we blog it, so it's all on our website if you're interested. And our primary concern was the energy source, not desal. Desal is very high energy intensive. We weren't so worried about salt going into the ocean. That is a problem in some areas like the Persian Gulf. We've got to increase salination of the Persian Gulf, but in the particular desal plant, if I remember correctly, that wasn't an issue. The main issue was energy source, because, of course, it consumes a lot of energy. So in that case, it was a gas-fired. Now, it wasn't great, but at least it wasn't coal. So we pinged it. We said, this isn't great. But, you know, we said, look, it was only a small part of the portfolio. Hey, beginning days of green bond market. We haven't got clear criteria out there yet. You know, let's be a little bit accepting of it. But listen, guys, never say desal again, please. Never say desal again. Explain yourself properly. And they undertook to do that in future with their bonds. And that's kind of what we're doing in this market. Ideally, I would expect desal to be fueled by clean energy, and you'd want some demonstrable certainty about that for a variety of reasons, especially in the context of people choosing desal over demand management, which is a really bad fundamental decision. In Sydney, where I come from in Australia, the government chose desal over adequate demand management. And that, in my argument, was a bad decision in the context of climate change. It is complicated, I have to say, when we get down to these levels. We need clear information. We need to convert those agencies of the world that are looking at this, like the International Energy Agency, like the Tyndall Centre, like the Grantham Institute at Imperial, to loads of knowledge about the kinds of things we need to do in the future, what kind of 2050 world we need to build. So that's my key point about that. On the back of that, we then have a universe in which to engineer investability. Look, it is like war. We need to be thinking that the change we have to achieve is very quick. Wars, I hate to use that metaphor, but nevertheless, are not won by free market forces. They are won by very strong states. We are at a point in history where we need strong states. So despite my concerns of human rights in China, I am a very big fan of what China is doing now around its environmental challenge. It is incredible, honestly. It is incredible. And India. Despite my concerns about the social policies of a government that in India, what they are doing around energy efficiency, around rail, around water, is incredible. In the rail, just to give you an example, they already carry a third of the country's freight. God, I wish Europe was the same, which is a better rail nation. And they're planning to carry a half by 2050 on the railways, despite growing the economy 7 to 10% per annum. That is the kind of ambition that every country around the world needs to have, frankly. So I will absolutely use them as poster children for the kinds of government action that we need. And the UK is letting the ball go. You know, we are too often sacrificing the ambition we need to have on the back of short-term expediency or the myth of gas or these sorts of things. So, and let's face it, there aren't many countries in Europe that are moving fast enough. So we can have a longer discussion about that, and then we go to the States, which is depressing, apart from California. Well, I have to say that because one of my board members is the Treasurer of California. They're fantastic, aren't they? But they are fantastic in terms of their ambition. So this issue about how we change and how we use the state is important. Now, when we get into a complicated discussion about it, it's not a matter of fiat, you know, because we want sustainable, effective change. I'm a great believer in behavioural economic solutions wherever you can. I'm a great believer in opt-out, opt-in. There's a long discussion about the detail and the role of the state as an enabler, as a facilitator of change. I'm not necessarily a big fan, my personally, of straightforward state direction of all the complexities. And I'll give you an example. We saw this in 2008 in China. One of the reasons China is adopting the more sophisticated approaches now, the greater market economy, is because of a very straightforward, blunt instrument of throwing money at municipalities to keep the economy moving, which worked, by the way, and saved the world's bacon to a certain degree. Nevertheless, they had massive capital misallocation. About 25% of that capital was misallocated into dud investments, and they know that. And now they're looking at a more sophisticated, fiscally efficient means of allocating capital, still with broad state direction. And that is, I think, where the juice lies for us. We're coming from the other direction. We kind of abandoned state allocation of capital in the 80s because of some kind of lunatic economists that were floating around. And now we need to rediscover that in a time of crisis and urgency, we need to have some part of it, but there's a matter of how we do it effectively. NGOs and development agencies and so on need to be the voice of ambition. They need to remind us of the likely suffering of the poor. At the moment, frankly, the certain suffering of the poor going forward.
the certain suffering of the poor based on our current trajectory and hold us accountable for our lack of action, for our lack of ambition, for our lack of willingness to do what our climate scientists have been saying for 20 years we must do. It's not a choice. And that's what aid agencies and developed NGOs should be doing. And I just want to say on retail, I'm a very big fan of retail. It's a simple thing to do. Osborne had in his election policy, election before last, green ISAs. He banned it. There could easily be tax credits for green bonds. I don't think it's going to raise a lot of money. But you know what? It's a great way to engage the public. It's a great way to have us all, like Suzanne, as an investor, feel part of this revolution. And I want to be able to put my teensy little pension pot into green stuff because I'm so, as you can tell, a little bit passionate about this. And I think that's a reasonable ask. It's a reasonable ask of us all. For that reason, I do hope this year we'll see some, but it is a do.
Okay, it's almost 8 o'clock, so it's time to draw this to a close. Let me thank our two speakers, Suzanne Bakhter, Sean Kitney, for a really fascinating talk. Let me also thank everybody for coming, and let me thank the Business and Finance Society for organizing the event.